We live in the world, which is headed and run by the prince of the power of the air. But we live by the Spirit, discerning the times. For he who is spiritual discerns all things. Sharpen your discernment. Build your faith. Listen to the Word and World Team. Minister the Word of God through conversational theology, piercing the darkness of this present evil age.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Welcome back. This is Hampton Keithley with Bob Brandon, and we are continuing our book review of Rodney Stark's How the West Won. And today we're going to tackle Chapter 7, Climate, Plague, and Social Change. So how are you today, Bob?
I'm fine, Hampton. Thank you. And I'm also excited. What two subjects in one chapter? You would almost think he's talking about today. You know,
yeah, but it was uncanny, you know, that, yeah, he wrote this, I don't know, what, 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And you know, the stuff that we've gone through recently is kind of similar.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking that he would put in there the famous, so he's going to talk about the Black Plague a fair amount, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought he was going to put in there that famous nursery rhyme that is just horrifying once you put it in the context of the Black Plague.
Is this the Ring Around the Rosies one?
Ring Around the Rosie, you know, and that line, we all fall down. Oh my gosh.
That came from this time period?
Yeah, I think so.
Interesting.
But I didn't see that in there. Although I learned a lot. So it's great material.
Yeah. I thought it was very interesting.
But I thought we could begin with another chapter from one of my favorite authors, human authors, Daniel. Donnie L., God is my judge. And last time we read about the lion's den. This time we read, you know, now the book kind of shifts from the first six chapters are different than the last six. Now we just get into what's typically labeled apocalyptic, right? We get
Chapter
into
Daniel's
visions and so on. But keep in mind, as we do that, we're really getting more material on Daniel chapter 2. So Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar had the dream, and, you know, of the statue.
Right.
And, oh, there are four components to it, and those represent four kingdoms coming on the earth. So here's Daniel 7, and it's the same material, but it's expressed through Daniel's dream, you know, okay, those four kingdoms. So anyway, how about we just hop in and read that?
Sounds good.
This is Daniel chapter 7. In the first year of King Belshazzar of Babylon, Daniel had a dream filled with visions while he was lying on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream in summary fashion. Daniel explained, I was watching in my vision during the night as the four winds of the sky were stirring up the great sea. Then four large beasts came up from the sea. They were different from one another. The first one was like a lion with eagle's wings. As I watched, its wings were pulled off. It was lifted up from the ground. It was made to stand on 2 feet like a human being, and a human mind was given to it. Then a second beast appeared. Like a beast, it was raised up on one side, and there were three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. it was told, get up and devour much flesh. After these things, as I was watching, another beast like a leopard appeared with four bird-like wings on its back. This beast had four heads, and ruling authority was given to it. And after these things, as I was watching in the night, visions, a fourth beast appeared, one dreadful, terrible, and very strong. It had two large rows of iron teeth. It devoured and crushed anything that was left. It trampled with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that came before it, and it had 10 horns. As I was contemplating the horns, another horn, a small one, came up between them, and three of the former horns were torn out by the roots to make room for it. This horn had eyes resembling human eyes and a mouth speaking arrogant things. While I was watching, thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His attire was white like snow. His hair, the hair of his head, was like lamb's wool. His throne was ablaze with fire, and its wheels were all aflame. A river of fire was streaming forth and proceeding from his presence. Many thousands were ministering to him. Many tens of thousands stood ready to serve him. The court convened, and the books were opened. Then I kept on watching because of the arrogant words of the horn that was speaking. I was watching until the beast was killed, its body destroyed and thrown into the flaming fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their ruling authority had already been removed, though they were permitted to go on living for a time and a season. I was watching in the night visions, and with the clouds of the sky, one like a son of man was approaching. He went up to the Ancient of Days and was escorted before him. To him was given ruling authority, honor and sovereignty. All peoples, nations, and language groups were serving him. His authority is eternal, it will not pass away. His kingdom will not be destroyed. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed, and the visions of my mind were alarming me. I approached one of those standing nearby and asked him about the meaning of all this. So he spoke with me and revealed to me the interpretation of the vision. These large beasts, which are four in number, represented four kings who will arise from the earth. The holy ones of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will take possession of the kingdom forever and ever. Then I wanted to know the meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others. It was very dreadful, with two rows of iron teeth and bronze claws, and it devoured, crushed, and trampled anything that was left with its feet. I also wanted to know the meaning of the 10 horns on its head, that other horn which came up and before which three others fell. This was the horn that had eyes and a mouth speaking arrogant things, whose appearance was more formidable than the others. While I was watching, that horn began to wage war against the holy ones and was defeating them until the Ancient of Days arrived and judgment was rendered in favor of the holy ones of the Most High. Then the time came for the holy ones to take possession of the kingdom. This is what he told me. The fourth beast means that there will be a fourth kingdom on earth that will differ from all the other kingdoms. It'll devour all the earth and will trample and crush it. The 10 horns mean that 10 kings will arise from that kingdom. Another king will arise after them, but he'll be different from the earlier ones. He will humiliate three kings. He'll speak words against the Most High. He will harass the holy ones of the Most High continually. His intention will be to change times established by law. They will be delivered into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. But the court will convene, and his ruling authority will be removed, destroyed, and abolished forever. Then the kingdom, authority, and greatness of the kingdoms under all of heaven will be delivered to the people of the holy ones of the Most High. His kingdom is an eternal kingdom. All authorities will serve him and obey him. This is the conclusion of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts troubled me greatly. The color drained from my face, but I kept the matter to myself. That's Daniel chapter 7, Hampton.
There's a lot in there.
Well, imagine. So Stark is doing, you know, the history of how the West won. Well, Daniel's doing the history of the world, right? For, you know, till Christ returns.
Yeah.
So there is a lot in there. How about this observation to start off with? They're pictured as the kingdoms that come upon the earth are pictured as beasts.
Mm-hmm.
And in Genesis 1 and 2, it's man, not animals, that's supposed to rule the earth, right? And then the kingdom will be given over to one like the Son of Man will ultimately come, right? You'll have human dominion. So I was thinking about this in the early morning hours. I'm on some weird sleep cycle now, Hampton.
Oh, yeah?
I go to bed at like 8 at night. I'm so tired I can barely get to the bed. I wake up at midnight. And I'm up. So about 2 or 3 this morning, I was working on something, and I was comparing Psalm 8 with Genesis 1. It seems like the Psalms in many ways are commentary on the earlier scriptures. Not all the way, you know, that's not 100% correspondence, but there's some elements of that. And so it seems like Psalm 8 is commentary on Genesis 1. And as David looks up at the heavens to contemplate the glory and majesty of God, his next thought is to look at earth and mankind's dominion. In other words, a clear view into the glory of God is human dominion. That sounds strange at first, but here you have it in Daniel, clear as a bell,
mm-hmm.
right? All these kingdoms will ultimately be given over to Jesus Christ, a human being. So scriptures never really let go of that theme. That's why. So here's a little trivia. Then we'll get to the text, Hampton, because I know you want to rabbit trail me on some trivia. Well, how about this? As recorded in the gospel accounts, the very first public words out of John the Baptist's mouth were, "Behold, the kingdom of heaven is at hand." The very first public words out of Jesus's mouth were, "Behold, the kingdom of heaven is at hand."
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And that's Daniel, right? This is what's going to crush the fourth beast. Here comes the Son of Man. So the scripture never really lets go of that theme.
That's good.
Okay, champ.
Okay, climate, plague, and social change. I'm just going to read the first paragraph here. It says, if historians have been rather inattentive to matters of geography, they have been even less attuned to the implications of climate and disease. Of course, the obvious effects of climate, that Eskimos use sleds and Bedouins do not, have always been noted. What has been given little attention are significant climate changes. In part, this is because until Hubert Lamb wrote about them in 1965, it was not widely recognized that there had been any substantial climatic changes since the end of the Ice Age, 20,000 years ago, despite the fact that the history of medieval Europe hinges on two major shifts in climate. By the same token, although the conquest of many chronic diseases is regarded as an essential feature of the rise of modernity, historians have largely ignored epidemics, which have had far more dramatic effects on the course of history. Incredibly, generations of historians dismissed the death of nearly half the world's population from the Black Death in 1346 to 1351 as of little significance compared with, say, the Hundred Years' War, 1337 to 1453. Serious historical studies of the Black Death did not begin until well into the 20th century, and even now these studies are pursued as an isolated subject matter. And so he goes on to list a couple books from 2006 and 1996. And these are history of Europe, and they have 1,300 pages, and they devote like 2 pages, you know, to the subject.
Yes. Let me bounce off that real quick, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Because it, you know, this struck me again just listening to you read that. One of my favorite experiences when I was very young, I was still in high school, and I went to the hospital with my dad a few times. He was a OBGYN in Cleveland, Ohio. So he did a fair amount of surgery. So he'd take me in there with him, and they'd let you do stuff. You know, I'm not sure the patients ever knew that, but anyway, so I'm standing there one time, and at this point I was with a urologist, and he had a cystoscope, and he said, "Why don't you look in that?" And so, you know, he's got it inserted in the patient. And so I look in there, I can't see anything. And I felt embarrassed, because I thought, you know, certainly I should be seeing something. I said to him, "I can't see anything. You know, it's just a total blur." And he goes, "I know." And he goes, "Now watch this." He, you know, pushes some button, and then all of a sudden you could see the structures inside there. And what had happened is there's some water that goes through that scope, and it pushes back the structures so that you can view it. Without pushing them back, you have no perspective. It's just a blur.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, you need that space and able to see. And that lesson always stuck with me, you know, that you really got to back up sometimes and get a huge perspective. Just that first paragraph that you read, if I was trying to take over the world and I read that chapter or that paragraph, I would conclude, you know what I need? I need some climate change, and I need a pandemic.
Yeah.
See, my brain doesn't work like, you know, I would never do that, right? But if I put myself with some perspective into that chair, hey, I want to take over the world, that's how I would do it. And that looks like that's what's been done.
Yeah. It does. Well, he points out that we hear a lot about climate change today, like you're talking about, but the climate has been making nearly large swings between hot and cold for all of history. And so he goes into detail about the huge warming period that was from, you know, 800 to 1250. And then there was a little ice age after that. And, you know, in the midst of those larger trends, there might be a whole decade where it was a little warmer or a little colder than normal. But there was this overall huge warming thing that happened.
Right.
And so he said that the Vikings benefited a lot from the warming period. And
you grow some more food, right?
Yeah. And they allowed them to travel to Iceland, to Greenland, and all the way over to Newfoundland. And
North. Yeah.
So Columbus didn't discover America. It was the Vikings. But... but I, you know, I found it interesting that Greenland was actually green during this warm period.
Right.
And then when it turned cold and the ocean froze around Greenland, then the people were stranded there.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't, you know, they didn't have, I guess they didn't have trees. And so they couldn't even build their own ships. And it got so cold, the grass wouldn't grow. The animals had nothing to eat. The animals died. The people had nothing to eat. And all the people died.
Yeah, we got stranded on that huge.
So have you ever heard the claim that Eric the Red named Greenland to deceive people into moving there? And he named Iceland as Iceland to discourage people from moving there?
I have not heard that.
Well, that's something I learned or was told back in my, you know, younger days, school or whatever. But it makes me wonder if someone just made that up, because it sounds like Greenland was actually green.
Oh, you mean more of the social imaginary?
Yes, there you go.
Perhaps.
So I don't know if that's true, but it just made me question that.
Sure.
But because of the warmer weather, the crops flourished. There was more to eat. The population of Europe went from 25 million in 950 to 75 million by 1250.
Yeah, I mean, and then phenomenal yeah, growth.
Yeah, then he says, and then it ended brutally.
There you go. Well, let's clarify one thing too, as we continue on. What's discussed in today's news is man-made climate change. What Stark is talking about is natural climate change. Right?
Yeah.
There's a huge difference.
He has a whole paragraph I probably should read under medieval climates that says the question arises.
Okay.
How do we know that these climatic periods took place? Until recent times, our only sources were literary, as when a medieval diarist noted that this was a year without summer, or an English pastor wrote a friend about ice skating on the Thames. Then came archaeological evidence, such as an analysis of skeletons showing how the Viking colony on Greenland slowly died out from malnutrition. But we now have a far more general, accurate, and sensitive database on the climate obtained from tree rings, from ice cores drilled in glaciers in many parts of the Earth. Ice cores have annual layers similar to tree rings. Chemical and isotopic analyses of ice cores reveal many aspects of climate, including temperature ranges, ocean volume, precipitation, chemistry of the lower atmosphere, volcanic eruptions, solar variability, and even the prevalence of forest fires. Because of the great depth of some glaciers, it has been possible to reconstruct the climate for a period stretching back several hundred thousand years. Of course, a recent scandal concerned the falsification of these data on behalf of the man-made global warming thesis, a fraud that involved minimizing the warmth of the medieval warm period and maximizing the temperatures of the Little Ice Age to create the so-called hockey stick graph of temperatures for the past millennium. Now that this fraud has been detected, there can be no doubt that such warm and cold periods occurred and that they greatly influenced human events. So for them to claim that the warming is man-made, they had to flatten the previous 1,000 years of warming and freezing.
Yep. So, but let me point something else out in there, because we've got to just make this apparent. I don't want to delve, you know, for a couple podcasts into the science of this, but you notice he's talking about hundred thousands of years.
Right.
It's wrong.
Yes.
So what they're doing with those ice core samples is assuming that, you know, a certain layer represents a year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it does. That can be a really cold day or that could be a day. That could be a very small fraction of time as opposed to a year.
Or a week or something.
Or a week. Or a month, right? But it's not necessarily a year. They're assuming that. So they're time things. His overall point is correct, but the precision of it is not correct.
Right.
But just so we're clear on that. And when he says, you know, he mentions fraud. Oh my gosh, was it 10, 15 years ago or so? Wherever they keep those records, it's somewhere like in Reykjavik or something, you know, that the climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Where that's, I forget exactly what city that's in, but you know, they were hacked. All these guys saying that there's man-made climate change, all that data was hacked And in there are just statements. Hey, we're making this up. You know, this is how we make our living. Literally, I'm obviously putting that in my words, but it was as clear as that. They're not giving you real data.
That's crazy.
So anyway, man-made global warming completely seems to me made up. It's very hard to get data on that. And I just don't see it happening. That there is climate change, you know, no question. That's fluctuated.
But that's his point. There's always been climate change.
Right, right. So go ahead.
So he goes back. I'm going to move on down to the Little Ice Age. He says, during the winter of 1310 to 11, Londoners danced around fires on the frozen Thames River, something that had never happened before. Then starting in the early spring of 1315, rain poured down for weeks and weeks, making it impossible to farm. All across Western Europe, dikes were destroyed by floods and new lakes and marshes appeared. In August, the weather turned bitterly cold. Hunger began to spread. The next spring, heavy rains again prevented planting. And so again, there was no harvest, nor was there fodder for the flocks. Famine became widespread. Meanwhile, intense gales battered the coastal areas. By 1317, all of Northern Europe was starving, even the nobility. Although the weather returned to normal that summer, the misery continued because people had been so weakened. So much of the seed stock had been eaten, and even the horses and oxen used for plowing had been consumed. By the time the famine ended in 1325, perhaps 10% of the population had died of starvation and starvation-related diseases. Even then, although the famine was over, agricultural production continued to decline because of bad weather. Grain yields can be measured in terms of the ratio of seeds, and I'm not going to get into all that, but it was way down. And then with colder weather came more severe storms. The worst were enormous gales that drove tidal waves onto the western Atlantic shores, drowning tens of thousands. So,
yeah. You anyway. Imagine, well, so his point is how that would affect history is a massive effect, right?
Right. Well, and I got to think that this was a weakened population.
Right.
You know, they were not healthy. They were all starving. And then comes the Black Death.
Right.
And that was the bubonic plague, and it was transmitted by infected fleas on rats that came from China. There we go. Another plague from China.
Oh, yeah, Yersinia pestis, the organism, right, that causes Black Plague. Yeah, there you go. How prescient was this book?
Yeah. It says the plague raged across Europe for 4 years, 1348 to 51, beginning in the south and moving north. And although the mortality rate may have varied from one region to another, everywhere huge numbers died. In 1351, Pope Clement VI asked his staff to calculate the number killed by the plague, and they arrived at a figure of 23,840,000, or about 30% of the population. And he says, I thought this was interesting, apparently this total was based on actual reports and was not influenced by the fact that Revelation 9:18 predicts that a third of mankind will be killed by plague.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're living through that, you guys, I think you would be going, wow, this is a fulfillment of Revelation.
You would. And again, you know, we've pointed this out before. Stark's not a biblical scholar.
Right.
So I imagine what he's referring to there. He just, you know, has a brief quote, you know, from. Yeah. It's just interesting to think about. I mean, that number does jump off the page, you know, a third of mankind.
Right.
And that does echo the Bible. It's, well, we'll pose this question at the end, but maybe we could just hint at it now. Boy, it makes you think in biblical terms. You know, what would a Christian in that day have thought?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So go ahead.
Well, I can't help but think about Zelensky when he was before the Jewish health council or whatever, and they asked his opinion, and he said 2 billion people are going to die from this vaccine.
Yeah.
And you know, then you're going, that's about a third.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's, you know, another thing that I love that he said. So who we're referring to as like Trump's doctor, right? And he held, you know, a position. Well, did he actually hold a position in the cabinet or anything? Or he was just Trump's personal doc? He helped him through his kind of COVID thing. Anyway, very well-known doc around New York City, prominent Jewish guy, and a lot of ties back to Israel, spoke out about what was happening when this all began. And my favorite thing that he said was this. He goes, I've been accused of having a conspiracy theory. He goes, when you have as much data as I have, it's a fact. He goes, it's a conspiracy fact. It's no longer theory when you have this much data. It was well said. Yeah. You know who else is saying that now, Hampton? I don't want to make this another podcast on the vaccine issues, but McCullough in Dallas.
Oh yeah.
Starting to say very similar things, like every state that allows the vaccine to continue to be administered should be held guilty of murder. Literally guilty of murder. That's McCullough, probably the country's leading cardiologist. Why is he saying that? Right? Well, he's got data. He's not going off half-cocked. So anyway.
He said there were several more plagues over the next, I don't know, 30 or 40 years. And so they just kept depleting the population, and half to two thirds of the population was killed.
Yeah. I like the paragraph where he says the horror of what took place is difficult to imagine.
Oh, I can't imagine.
Yeah. Well, and then back to our nursery rhyme, right? Mm-hmm. We all fall down. Wow.
Yeah, there was a section called reactions when he talked about the flagellants.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess those were guys that went around whipping themselves.
And yeah, I was unaware of that.
I hadn't heard of that. And so there was some, you know, a lot of, I guess, maybe some revival going on. People were thinking that this was all, the results of their sin and all that. And then there was a whole thing where they started blaming the Jews. I found that kind of interesting. But the Pope came out and said, hey, cut that out. It's not the Jews' fault. And everybody obeyed except for this people that lived along the Rhine River in Germany.
Yeah, how interesting is that?
And so he makes the comment towards the end of that says, for this same reason, heretical Christian movements were highly successful here too, as was Luther's, he's talking about this Rhineland area, as was Luther's Reformation. Unfortunately, the vicious anti-Semitic culture of these cities did not die out with the waning of medieval times, but lived on to support Hitler's final solution.
Yeah. What does that make you think?
What does it make me think of?
Yeah. What's that make you think? Because I can tell you what that makes me think.
Well, I just find it interesting that area that the Germans have been so anti-Semitic for so long, you know.
Well, right. And so what that makes me think is, you know, I don't see the world as just, you know, the human world. I see the spiritual world at the same time. I try to anyway.
Yeah, no, that's good.
Right. So has there been a dark entity that's ruled that part of the world from time immemorial, keeps popping his head up now and then? That's what that makes me think. There's evidence for that in the scriptures, right? Someday we'll do a podcast on that where I'll detail that all out. But from Deuteronomy and Daniel, there's evidence of that. So you wonder if there's just a dark angel over that area. But
right.
Anyway, food for thought.
Next section was stagnant demography. And basically it did not, this population didn't bounce back. And I got ahead of myself. That's because they kept having more and more plagues.
Yeah, that wasn't a one and done thing.
Right.
It kept sweeping over.
And he said the estimate is that the population declined between 60% and 75%.
Gosh, I mean, it's just, you can't even imagine that today.
Right. So the social implications or results of all of this was the end of serfdom.
And, yeah, and that's an interesting institution.
Yes. And so the serfs did most of the farming in Europe. And, you know, people like to compare serfs with slaves. And we didn't really get into that, I think, in a previous chapter. But he pointed out serfs were not slaves. They made agreements with the Lord that they would, you know, work for a percentage, you know, for protection and that kind of thing. But with so many people dying, there was a whole lot of extra land available.
Yeah.
And so people just started claiming the empty land, and they needed laborers, and there weren't that many people. And so they had to hire people. And so then there was competition and wages rose.
Right.
And because it was so cold, there was a great demand for wool in the colder climates there. And wool clothing factories sprang up, and people moved to the city to work in them. And so you saw a kind of an exodus of from the farms to the cities.
Yeah.
So the landowners, you know, go started raising livestock because it didn't take as many workers. And all that extra meat and protein from the livestock made people grow bigger and stronger.
So it's almost as if, you know, it's a snapshot in time of market forces.
Mm-hmm.
And how they work, right? And they work really well. That's not to say that there isn't hardship in life, you know, but you're never going to get rid of that. But an unfettered market naturally meets the needs of the people.
Right.
And right. It's when you get into government control that the thing starts going off the rails. If you just let the market respond to stuff, you know, like we've had this phrase, you know, when Obama came in, you know, some of these companies are too big to fail. We need an $800 billion, influx of money into the economy to save let them die.
Right.
Right. And I understand there's hardship involved in that, but there's a lot more hardship involved in propping something up that should fail.
Spending money you don't have and going in.
Right. Yeah. Money you don't have anyway. Oh my gosh. So anyway, that's how I read this section. It was interesting to me to see the market forces at work. And the serfs started like bargaining, you know, like their wages are going up. They're going, you need me to do this work. I'm not begging you anymore. I cost X amount. It was fun to see.
Yeah. Yeah. He has the next section, innovations, and I thought it was interesting. He goes, in a charming posthumously published book, the 20th century historian David Hurley proposed the plausible thesis that the labor shortages caused by the Black Death stimulated the invention and development of labor-saving technology. So when he says in a charming...
Yeah, he's making... Yeah.
I'm sitting there going, I think he's making fun.
Sure.
And he says, though, a little later on, he says it's an elegant thesis, but thus far, no one has discovered any credible examples of labor-saving technologies prompted by the labor shortages resulting from the Black Death.
Yeah, he's looking for real data.
Yeah. And so he says, in contrast, a number of innovations can plausibly be attributed to the Little Ice Age. Glass windows storm doors, skis, ice skates, sunglasses to prevent snow blindness, distilled liquor, trousers. I guess people's legs were cold, so they figured a way to cover them.
Sure.
Fitted clothing, buttons, and chimneys. And he has a whole interesting thing about chimneys and how that changed culture. Because used to be you just built a hut and built your fire in the middle of the room and had smoke everywhere.
Yeah, I like the example he gave too of like proving that, because it was assumed by the historians, again, the social imaginary at work, that it was just the wealthy that had chimneys. But when you look at the artwork of the day, even the small buildings, the peasants had chimneys.
Right.
Right. So that must, well, so that's what they're seeing, right? Mm-hmm. They're not imagining that.
Right. Yeah. And so they ended up with smaller rooms and more privacy, and because all the little rooms, little chimneys, well, a chimney could not heat a great room very well.
Right.
And so that changed and helped changed morality and privacy and things like that.
Yep.
And then misreading history is the conclusion.
My favorite section.
Yeah. Huh. I'm just going to read it. It says, generations of historians and social scientists embraced Thomas Malthus's, we talked about Malthusian stuff last time, I think.
Yep.
Claimed that the famine of 1315 to 18, the devastation by the Black Death and other such catastrophes were positive checks on population, triggered seemingly automatically to keep the populace proportionate to the food supply. That is, famines and plagues are the normal results of there being too many people. During the 1960s and early 70s, the Malthusian theory of population reigned supreme in academia, as every sociology textbook, including early editions of mine, thought that was interesting, warned that we could expect tragedy to strike at any moment. Stanford University's Paul Ehrlich pontificated in his bestseller, The Population Bomb, 1968. The battle to feed all humanity is over. In the 1970s, the world will undergo famines. Hundreds of millions are going to starve to death. Also in the late 60s, the celebrated scientist C.P. Snow told the New York Times, perhaps in 10 years, millions of people in the poor countries are going to starve to death before our very eyes. We shall see them doing so upon our television sets. Nothing of the sort happened, of course, and it has slowly dawned on historians and social scientists that Malthusian theory tells us nothing about the disasters of the 14th century either. The famine of 1315 was caused by weather, not overpopulation. Prior to the sudden, nearly total destruction of crops, the food supply was quite sufficient. As for the Black Death, it was caused by bubonic plague, and it struck as hard or harder in sparsely settled places, such as Iceland, as it did in crowded London and Paris. In any event, for good and for ill, both the climatic changes and the Black Death had significant influences on the course of Western civilization.
Yeah, it's good to set up the following chapters that way. You know, two huge events that are so echoed in our society today. I love this one phrase, you know, in his first sentence of that section. The devastation by the Black Death and other such catastrophes were positive checks on population. That's been thought by the intelligentsia for a long time. And that's what I believe is the current thought behind what we're going through today.
Oh, yeah. I had to think that, you know, our global elites, they want to reduce the population. And I'm wondering,
100%.
Do they subscribe to the Malthusian theory?
Doesn't it seem like it? I mean, 100%.
Yeah.
And it was wrong then. And it's wrong now.
Right.
So.
Well, I think it's a common misconception that starvation is a world problem.
Mm-hmm.
I read a few years ago that the world's problem is now obesity. And
oh boy.
Not just America, but the whole world. We had so much food. But then I also heard, because of the lockdowns, that people were talking about how the disruption of the food supply chain, that millions of people would die from starvation because the food couldn't get to them that was being grown.
Yes.
You know, and I guess they're doing the same thing in, is it the Netherlands? That's a huge farming area, and they're taking away the farmers'
their land. What I would like to leave our listeners with is, you know, trying to dig down into some of these fundamental ideas that are controlling our culture, and that overpopulation, you know, the belief in that is primary.
Yeah.
The global elites think that the world is overpopulated, and they want to reduce that number. That is compelling almost all of their decisions and actions. They believe that, and they're going about doing that. So anyway, as you observe current events, keep that foundational principle in mind.
Right. Well, we ended on such a positive note.
Well, yeah, I know, but here's the ultimate positive note was what we read in Daniel.
There you go.
Those kingdoms are going to be done away with, right? The beastly kingdoms. And Jesus Christ will set up his eternal kingdom. That is the plan. When you're omniscient and omnipotent, you don't make a plan B. That is plan A. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah. I think that's one of my favorite sayings. God doesn't have a plan B.
No.
So, okay. Well, thanks a lot. And I will talk to you next time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Therefore, I exhort you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a sacrifice, alive, holy, and pleasing to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this present world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may test and approve what is the will of God, what is good and well-pleasing and perfect.